This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. You're listening to episode 133 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David in freezing Philly. hey, Max, another week. Bitter cold here, but, you know, I'm jealous of our guest tonight. We're going to be below zero as far as temperatures go. But we have a guest, and he's in sunny Florida, and I'm pretty jealous.
Myself as well. Our guest is Jonathan Ruprecht. Now, Jonathan is a commercial pilot. He's got single and multi-engine aircraft ratings. He's also a flight instructor. He has a Bachelor of Science in Professional Aeronautics from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University and his law degree from Florida International University School of Law. Ruprecht Law provides legal services for operators of unmanned aerial vehicles. And we last talked to Jonathan back on episode, I think it was 97. Jonathan, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
I understand you're in pretty high demand these days, giving presentations, making many media appearances, and you've got a number of books, including what, one that's about to come out?
Yeah, I'm co-authoring one right now that should be coming out pretty soon. I just published the drone operator's logbook because there was no decent logbook actually out there. Because you know how these manned aircraft logbooks are, where lots of the columns are completely irrelevant, like multi-engine aircraft or single engine. Like, really, I'm flying a single engine like drone? No. So I created one that was FAR, COA, and 333 compliant. So the commercial guys and the recreational guys can both use it.
Yeah, the one coming out, is that unmanned aircraft in the national airspace?
No, that's already out. So there's I've published multiple books. So there's drones are many civilian uses in the U.S. laws surrounding them. That's already out. The unmanned aircraft in the national airspace one, that got published by the American Bar Association. Then it was the drone logbook, and now I'm working on another one. And then there's another one in the works after that. So
you're very prolific.
Well, you got to keep it moving. You know, it's like sharks. They have to keep moving to stay alive. Not to compare lawyers to sharks or myself to a shark. Anyway, moving on.
Yeah, okay. We'll leave that one at that. All right. Well, David, what do you say we get started?
Yeah, I think we will. We're going to sort of mediate the conversation. Tonight, it's going to be about laws and regs and enforcement, which is Jonathan's expertise. So I guess we'll start off with our first topic, which would be Taylor versus the FAA. Jonathan's pretty intimate with this. If you don't know, this is a gentleman who, outside of DC, decided to sue the FAA because he wants to fly his model airplanes and drones. But I'm being a little obtuse about it. Jonathan, you want to go into a little bit more detail?
Sure. Yeah. I'm actually helping out behind the scenes with that case, doing a pro bono. And Mr. Taylor is mainly concerned with the FAA's overreach on what is that the FAA ignored the protections that were provided by Congress in Section 336 of the FAA Modernization and Reform Act of 2012, which prohibits the FAA from creating any rule or regulation governing model aircraft. And what did they do? They created a regulation that governed model aircraft. It's like, guys, this is kind of simple. And they told you not to do it, and you did it, so we're suing. Knock it off. That's basically the summation of the whole thing.
And then in the new air, the same regulation is there, is it not?
It is. Well, they keep wanting to regulate it, but then you're still going to have to, for purposes of, you know, 336, have to hash that all out. there's actually three cases going on. There is the kind of like Part 48, the whole paper-based, not paper-based, the electronically-based way to register aircraft versus 336, whether that's legal or not. Then there's the Part 47, now activation, if you will, because that's a regulation that's been in place for a long, long, long time, but it has never been applied to model aircraft. And so the FAA kind of just one day back in actually October, they kind of flipped the light switch on and was like, oh, now this regulation is actually going to apply. So that's not so much as a regulation as it's more of an interpretive rule that they kind of just turned on when they felt like it. So most people would not be so concerned about that. They just go like, hey, well, so what's the problem with registration? Why should we care? It's $5. That's how some people frame the argument. And it's not that. It's actually whether or not the FAA needs to follow the rules that Congress told them to follow. That's the debate. It's not $5. It's right. It's the FAA following the laws that they, you know, that actually govern them. And so the FAA is turning on this regulation to now apply to model aircraft. If they can do this, then the next step is recreational drone pilot's licenses. Because don't you have to be a licensed pilot to fly in the national airspace? Isn't that what the regulations say? Doesn't it also say that an aircraft has to have an airworthiness certificate and you have to do regular maintenance and all that, right?
Right. Well,
yeah. But they haven't done what? They haven't flipped those light switches on. They haven't traditionally applied those to model aircraft. And so every argument that the FAA is saying right now for registration, they can easily say for everything else that has long been held that, you know, by the statutes that were passed by Congress a long time ago, by the regulations that were enacted a long time ago, that we are required to enforce this, that we're just doing our job. So it's like, well, hey, but that stuff was kind of like locked in stone and by the 336.
Jonathan, has the FAA articulated any logic that leads them to the conclusion that they can regulate or issue rules pertaining to model airplanes?
Oh, yes. Two of their responses would be, one, that if you look at subsection C in 336, it specifically lists out the definition of model aircraft, but then the in subsection A, it says if you fall into these, it's you have to meet all the criteria for the use, then you actually are governed the protection. This is the FAA's argument. That's what I'm saying. They would say, we do not know which of the aircraft falling in the model aircraft definition category would actually be falling within the use operation requirements to give, you know, that to have the protection governed to them by Congress. So we don't know who's going to do that. So we're just going to require everyone to register. But that's one of their arguments. Okay. The second argument is this prohibition is specifically for singling out model aircraft individually. So we can't pick on them individually. We can, however, create a regulation that governs generally all aircraft, okay, or a particular group of aircraft. So they chose with the interim final rule that they came out with to govern all unmanned aircraft, which would be individuals, you know, flying commercially as well as falling outside of the model aircraft use categories as well as falling inside the use categories for model aircraft. And that's how they would argue it. We don't know, so we're going to get it all, and also that we can regulate people generally. While it's kind of a weird actual argument. It's kind of like an equal protection argument, something like going back to racial segregation and stuff. Like, we've got to include everybody. So it's kind of like this weird, well, we got to include the model aircraft. We can't leave them out. That's what Congress was saying. It's like, guys, I don't think that's what Congress was saying. I think they were trying to tell you guys to stop it. But, you know, clever arguments.
Where is this case being heard? Has the case actually started yet? Maybe we should start with that.
Yes, both of those, actually all three cases have been filed in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and that's what's going on right now. So that's the court that's primarily, most of the federal litigation against federal agencies goes on in that circuit. They're experts on this topic. And this is the one right below the United States Supreme Court. So, I mean, United States Supreme Court is probably not going to hear this because they rule on more, I guess, now this isn't important or anything, but that apply to everyone. As well, Jones don't generally apply to everyone. So it's kind of a higher stakes court, you know, to win or lose in, as opposed to like at a district court level, which is normally what most things go at. This is at the appeals court level. So this is like, you know, tier two, while Supreme Court is tier three.
Any idea how long this might take? I mean, is this something that could just drag on for so long that it, you know, kind of becomes irrelevant just because of the passage of time?
There's a possibility for that. I mean, these bills that are in Congress right now, somebody could pass something that could change it up. That is a possibility, but I don't really know what's going to be happening there. We have multiple bills, multiple people going in and lobbying. So I haven't really been paying too much attention to that area because it hasn't really got too far through the whole legislative process, for me to really focus heavily upon. I'm mostly focusing my time on this, these three cases. And the third case, because it's part 48 v. 336, then part 47 v. 336. And the third one would be the whole SFRA versus 336, because the FAA was, turning that light switch on and off, just like they were with the registration. So you could fly one day and then next day you can't. And then it was like, because what? Oh, because we said so. And because where? Did you say that in a NOTAM anywhere? No, we didn't, but we kind of put out a press release and it was on our website. And so nobody did. Oh, but now we're putting out another NOTAM the other day that says you can, but you still have to register, you know, so it's okay. So what is it? Do we just turn the light switch on and off? It's very, it's like that game, red light, green light, you know, red light, green light, red light, green light. Like, come on guys, what am I supposed to do here?
Jonathan, you're well versed in this, and we have a lot of other people who are well versed in this, but let's just backtrack for maybe some of our overseas listeners. What is part 48 versus 336?
The traditional way to register aircraft in the regulations is under Part 47. It's a paper-based setup that is very difficult to do because it's very precise and it takes time. Well, the FAA wanted to create a burden-relieving alternative. That's how they say it. And it's an electronic way to register aircraft. And so they've recently published, and it went into effect as of December the 21st, and it created Part 48, which is an electronic way of actually registering your aircraft so as to comply with the federal aviation regulations. 336 comes from the FAA Modernization Reform Act of 2012, which says, FAA, you cannot create any rule or regulation governing model aircraft. Well, Part 48 is very broad. It governs all unmanned aircraft. That would be the commercial as well as the model aircraft, which puts it in a direct collision course with the prohibitions listed in 336 to not create any regulations governing model aircraft.
And let's just round it out with what would be the SFRA?
Yes, the SFRA is the special flight rules area, and that is focusing specifically on, at Reagan International Airport, 30 nautical miles out to 15 nautical miles out. It's kind of like the outer donut of that airspace. Individuals could fly there before, and the inner donut around, inner DC, that was completely off limits. Well, the SFRA, what happened is then the FAA said you can't do it. While manned aircraft, you have to have some special training to fly in there. Model aircraft guys had not been traditionally held to those standards. So now these regulations, because it's a very sensitive area of our nation's infrastructure, was now activated, and all the model aircraft were temporarily grounded. So the special flight rules area applies to generally sensitive areas around the United States, and this is a particular special flight rules area around DC. It's in the regulations, basically.
Yeah. And this was the problem that we saw in the press articulated about a huge number of model airplane clubs suddenly no longer able to fly in the area around Washington, DC. But as you say, the FAA flip flops on this, and now I guess more recently it's permitted again.
Correct. Which that's one of the troubling parts about how the FAA is choosing to exercise its discretion when turning on the regulations on and off.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if this is an accurate characterization, but the way I think of this almost is this, is that the FAA has decided that small drones, UAS, small UAS, are aircraft. And once they declare that to be the case, then all the existing regulations that and rules that apply to aircraft suddenly apply to small UAS. And I mean, they have to follow those. So it kind of puts them in a situation of saying, like, maybe as you articulated before, we're sweeping all this under one umbrella, and it probably doesn't all belong under one umbrella.
Right. I totally agree with you. I mean, that's what's happening with the commercial drone operators, is that the FAA leaves the light switches on, if you will. They do not turn them off. And so in order to actually be compliant with the federal aviation regulations, be able to, you know, actually operate, make money, you then have to get an exemption from those regulations, which are so difficult to actually comply with. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of a bizarre way to do it. Is here, we're going to put everybody under the same umbrella, but then we're going to give everybody the permission to apply for an exemption. Instead of making rules for those people, you make the rules so that nobody can fly, and then you parse out the exemptions so you can fly. You're right. It is kind of a backwards way of approaching it without I guess it's a way of not micromanaging it. I don't know. What do you think, Jonathan?
The FAA is trying to be consistent with how they apply their regulations. So if it's determined to be an aircraft, therefore the logical extension is do that for the commercial. But why haven't they? The big issue is why do they treat the model aircraft guys and the commercial guys completely separate? That's a whole nother interesting discussion there. But the FAA is trying to create some commercial regulations. Back in February of last year, they published the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, and that is currently going through the regulatory process to the rulemaking process. And as of last week, I checked in the proposed regulations have still not even left the FAA for the Department of Transportation for review. And after DOT, it has to go to OMB and then OIRA. And so there's a whole bunch of legal hurdles. I estimate at least 6 months to maybe 3 years or so before you're actually going to have those become final. And when you do, then the commercial drone operators could actually operate under that, as opposed to Section 333, because then it'll be like a particular specific niche of operating rules that the drone operators that are operating commercially will just have to comply with. So it'll be much simpler, streamlined.
Jonathan, what about the issue of the definition of navigable airspace? Does it go down to the blades of grass, or does it reach down to some higher altitude than that? What are we seeing in your world in terms of addressing that issue?
Sure. There is a case currently going on right now at the federal district court level in Kentucky. It is the Meredith v. Boggs case. So we knew about the Boggs case before. He's the individual who shot the drone down. Well, this is the individual who owned the drone is actually in federal court trying to get a declaratory action from the federal judge on basically where is navigable airspace, because the whole idea behind the Boggs case in the state court was that Boggs was justified in his shooting down of the drone because the drone was seen by at least two witnesses at below the tree line. Therefore, it's in his property. Okay. Therefore, it's trespassing. He has a right to self-help. This isn't a human. So it's not like shooting a human. It's shooting an object. Or you're destroying their property. So he was exercising his right to self-help to remove this individual, object from his property. Well, in this case, if navigable airspace goes down to the blade of grass, Meredith was not trespassing with his drone. Therefore, Boggs had no right to actually use self-help and shoot down the drone. So that's one big issue there. Now, some of the fallouts from that is that if navigable airspace goes all the way down to the blade of grass, that's a big benefit. And as drone flyers, we actually want that, because then in court, when we challenge the states, counties, cities, towns for coming into this area and creating laws regulating this area. We could say, hey, this is a completely field preempted area. The FAA has regulated this area so heavily that you guys do not have any business whatsoever regulating it. And it goes to the blade of grass. Therefore, we're free to actually fly our quadcopters, our FPV racers doing this, and you can't say otherwise. Only the FAA can. You need to talk to FAA to take it up, take this issue up with them. Now, if the drone, if navigable airspace is said to be at the tree line or at the building height and on up, well, then that allows the cities, the states, the towns, the counties all to get in there. And then you have like kind of a death by a thousand paper guts kind of setup where everybody and their dog is. It seems like it's like the Tickle Me Elmo of law where everybody had to get into it and they're all, right? Like we have to do something. Safety, privacy, blah, blah, blah. And then they justify it and they throw it together. And now nobody knows what in the world is legal anymore. And you can't go to the FAA's website to actually find this out. It's just kind of like this piecemeal patchwork of stuff all over the place, hidden everywhere. And you don't even know if they use the proper terms. So when I've been dealing with the stuff where people have been getting either arrested around the country or getting warned, and you try to look up the ordinances and they call them all sorts of different things. So it's model aircraft, hobbyist aircraft, model airplanes, and unmanned aircraft vehicles, drones. It's like, so now you got to search all these little words, see if you get any hits to run through that. And even then you don't fully know. So, the big issue with preemption is we need to have one voice saying what goes on in this area, not a thousand people clamoring. And worse yet, a lot of these towns, cities, councils, states that are getting into the area have very little knowledge on unmanned aircraft or on aviation. They just kind of parrot stuff they hear back in the news, like, oh, you're not allowed to fly near airports or this or that and whatever else they kind of feel like. And then it becomes it's kind of like a bunch of people that don't know Spanish trying to create a Spanish exam based upon maybe a TV commercial they saw from Taco Bell saying, yo quiero Taco Bell, and they throw that on the exam. Like, okay, that sounds good. What else do we ask them? and it becomes like this mess and a hodgepodge. I've seen these hearings. One was so horrible that one guy said some completely just erroneous facts, and another guy said something going on the facts from guy A, and then guy C was piling on from A and B. And so it became this giant amalgamation of just incorrect facts. And that's when I realized, wait a second, A, B, C, and D, all these council members have no clue what's going on because none of them corrected all the inaccuracies of the other guys. It just like snowballed inaccuracies. And then it was just like, well, we're going to have, 50 to 100 pound drones flying down the beach as fast as possible to nearly kill people and spy on people. And it was like, huh? That what?
Yeah.
Where did you come up with these facts? Does anybody know what? So I think that's one of the big issues that Meredith v. Boggs case will determine is navigable airspace, because there's a lot of implications going on there. And it also spill over into what's going on at some of these the local level with prosecutions. So City of L.A. currently is prosecuting two individuals for flying against their drone ordinances. What's interesting is that one of the individuals was in the news reports that he was flying near a heliport. Okay. And you're like, oh, he's flying near a heliport. Oh, well, except for here's the whole thing. Like on the sectional, it's a private heliport that's not listed. That's kind of an interesting fact, because how was he supposed to know there was a heliport there, especially when it's on the third floor and the helicopter wasn't taking off, it was landing. Ooh, that's a good point, right?
Right,
so yeah. Kind of like there's a notice factor going on there. And then in the North Carolina state prosecution that's going on, the helicopter is not even spooled up. It's taking off. Once again, private heliport, not on the FAA sectional. And he was arrested for that. So you kind of have to ask, like, well, was this guy actually put on proper notice here? Or is he supposed to, like, just run around looking for helicopters everywhere? And then he can get nailed. So there's some big issues there. And then New York, some people have been arrested, and they kind of been arrested mostly under traditional laws like trespassing, noise ordinance, careless and reckless operation. And that's pretty much the overall theme that's been happening around the U.S. for one of those disorderly conduct or trespassing or noise ordinance violation, careless, reckless. Those are like the four major ones that are generally kind of applied to drone operators for some way that a police, police officer can get them for operating their drone.
Wow, this sounds like it's in some ways kind of the big overriding issue that needs to be determined as to what's the definition of the navigable airspace. It's almost as if almost everything else kind of falls out from that, or at least is determined based on the outcome of that.
Correct. Right. Yeah. Because if it's navigable airspace goes all the way to the blade of grass on the ground, well, these are aircraft. Okay. So then therefore FAA, all this jurisdiction is in their domain. Case law holds this to be a field preempted area, meaning that you guys can't be regulating us. So knock it off. And we actually as drone operators want that. That's a good thing. And hopefully something like that will come about. But I think most likely it's going to be through a patchwork of lawsuits going on. And stuff getting fought out in federal district courts, as well as the federal appeals courts, and maybe someday to the United States Supreme Court. Hmm.
Sometimes cases go one way or the other, not necessarily based on sort of the large overarching issues that some people may have, but the case gets decided on some smaller legal issues. And so the big picture issue doesn't get resolved sometimes in that particular case. What's your feeling when you look across all these cases in that regard? Do you think we're going to get to good answers reasonably quickly, or again, is this going to be some kind of a long process of, various cases at different levels that take a while for, the thing to be, settled in a way that lets everybody move forward?
Right. Well, I think, you bring up an excellent point here, because you have to have two sides that are willing to actually fight it out in tango. So, I mean, the Taylor case is a real good one there, because you have, Taylor and I, as well as some other individuals that are helping out behind the scenes, versus the Department of Justice. Okay, that sounds like two are ready to tango. We'll get a pretty good vicious fight going there. So there'll actually be some good cases and case law coming out of that. But the arrests that are happening around the country, well, what's happening is the police officer arrests the individual. The paperwork gets filed to the district attorney's office. They look at it to determine whether or not charges should be filed. And some of these guys are going to just be reading it like, what in the world is going on here? Right? Mm. They're just, okay, we're just going to dismiss this. Or the judge reads it and like, what is this? We don't even have jurisdiction to rule on this. The guy was flying his drone and you're saying he's trespassing. That's outside of our jurisdiction. So you have a natural effect of prosecutors and judges just kind of like ignoring and dismissing this stuff because they have no clue what to even do here. It's so foreign to them. So you're going to have to get a prosecutor to actually want to pick a fight, which that's kind of what's going on with the City of LA case. Both the prosecutors actually filed those charges and they're going forward with it. So unless the judge somehow wants to procedurally or somehow substantively of jurisdictional reasons get rid of it, then you might have a good little fight going there if they can also get some attorneys on the other side to hear that. Maybe that goes up to a federal district court and then up to the appeals court and then has some law. But there's going to be a lot of things that are going to get rid of these cases prematurely. Even though there's some good facts, they might not make it up their way. So more and more of this is going to have to happen. Eventually, you have some good cases that will actually come to case law fruition.
Fascinating stuff. And when I look at all this, my reaction is not that, boy, this drone stuff is just a horrible mess. And why is it so complicated? But instead, when I look at this, this is kind of the way it works, right? This is this is nothing out of the ordinary in terms of, when something new comes along and questions are asked that have never been asked before. And it's just a process to figure all this stuff out.
Exactly. I mean, the aviation, what we're dealing with here is actually, it's not new. And most people think, well, hey, what do you mean it's not new? Drones have only been around for a little while. Well, there have been these things called balloons that were invented a long time ago. And when balloons were flying around, people started asking these questions like, hey, what about invasion of privacy? Couldn't you have like some perpetrator, you know, some perv running around in a blimp or something, you know, in the backyard? And so they started asking these questions. But as time went on, well, the balloons weren't used as much because they're susceptible to, you know, they're at the mercy of the wind. But with airplanes, then you had the improvement of the technology where they started flying higher and faster. So this whole like 400 feet to the ground level was never really answered because the technology grew so fast, it basically like evaded review in courts. So we didn't really have that except for certain situations where the states, towns, counties were trying to regulate, you know, traffic landing, such as the city of Burbank case back in 1973, where they were trying to limit traffic from taking off after 11 p.m. So it's there. The technology has also played a very important role in this in this.
Well, David, do you feel better or do you feel worse after listening to this?
Is it okay if I can say I feel confused? I don't know if I feel better or worse. It's one of the reasons why you and I love this. I was a history major and I hated all the poli-sci people, and I've suddenly become a poli-sci major. It's there's a lot of case law being written, and it's kind of interesting, and I never thought I'd be saying that ever in my life. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel better, I think, because I think the issues are on the table now, and they're being dealt with. Now, again, they're not going to get resolved with the speed that I think many people would like to see. I mean, we have, you know, the hobbyists who want to be able to engage in their activities without a lot of extra requirements or, you know, unnecessary things that don't affect safety or whatever. And certainly the people who are looking towards commercial applications really want to get started on that so they can get the value that they can derive from these commercial applications. So it's just frustrating that, you know, that it's going to take so long.
Well, yeah, I mean, well, most people are thinking about the FAA, but they haven't really paid attention to the other federal agencies who have not got up to speed on the drone issues yet, which I think is going to be the real interesting point, is when what happens when the FCC all of a sudden realizes that a lot of the transmitters that are being used right now are completely non-Part 15 certified, and there are, the individuals flying them are non-ham, they don't have ham radio licenses. What about then? And they're on frequencies they shouldn't be on, transmitting on you know, wattage way higher, milliwatts way beyond what they're allowed. Or what about TSA? And that's why I'm like, oh, I'm really concerned when those guys start getting into the drone area. I'm not worried about the FAA. I'm like, those guys, when they start causing issues, there's going to be some issues there. And then frequency allocation and stuff like that. So
This is like the but wait, there's more moment.
Oh, see, now I'm getting depressed.
Now I'm a little nervous as well. All right. Well, David, we've just about used up all of our time for this episode.
Oh, but I gotta get my favorite story of the weekend.
Go ahead.
And that was, this is from Foxtrot Alpha at Jalopic. Area 51 banned drones. Well, at least your drones. Evidently, there were some new signages on the fences around Area 51 that it's a no drone zone. So we'll put a link to the show notes. I just think it's kind of funny that you're allowed to fly drones at Area 51. You're just not allowed to fly drones at Area 51. So, you know, it's
wonderful.
It's kind of. But yeah, we should move on.
How about the video of the week? We have a great video of the week.
Yeah, this is from our listener, Tom. Thanks, Tom, for this claustrophobe. This was not the video for me to be watching, but this was on Gizmodo. And he put in that he would never have thought that this was a use for UAVs. I got to admit, I was kind of surprised watching a UAV fly through a glacier. What did you think, Max?
Well, I actually have some history, if you go back far enough, with ice climbing and winter mountaineering. So I was fascinated by this. You know, one of the things when you're out there hiking across glaciers is you have to watch out for the crevasses. And I mean, you fall into one of those, and that's about all she wrote. And I've certainly never seen much in the way of video from inside a crevasse in the glacier. So what they've done here is put a little drone in. This is the flyability drone that is sort of inside that that kind of that wire mesh that's designed to, when it strikes
bounce
obstacles.
Off walls.
Right, bounce off walls. Of course, you know, you try flying it through a crevasse and that's nothing but walls. And it's fascinating to see what this ice formation looks like from the inside. It's also very interesting, I thought, to watch how this little drone reacts to the bumps and crashes into the walls, and how the camera remains stable even though the little drone is kind of bouncing around in there. So yeah, really fascinating video. Thanks, Tom, for sending that in to us.
I think we'll hold off on our listener mail to next week. So with that, I'd like to say thank you, Jonathan. And where can people, if they want to reach out to you and are about to be sued because they flew their drone over their neighbor's yard, how can they get a hold of you?
Sure, they can get a hold of me at my website, which is jruprechtlaw.com. That's spelled Juliet, Romeo, Uniform, Papa, Papa, Romeo, Echo, Charlie, Hotel, Tango, Lima, Alpha, Whiskey.com. And I hope I didn't scare anybody, but bring to light what is currently going on so that you guys can move forward, you know, safely as well as legally.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jonathan. So we also want to thank all of you for listening. This has been episode 133 of the UAV Digest. You can find us, as always, at theuavdigest.com. If you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, visit theuavdigest.com/133.
And if you'd like to support the show, there's multiple ways you can do it. You can follow us on Twitter at UAV Digest, and we just got over 6,000 Twitter followers. So thank you to everybody out in the Twitter sphere. On Facebook at facebook.com/theUAVDigest. And of course, we want to hear your videos, see your videos of the week and get your emails. And that can be done through our email address, which is feedback@theUAVDigest.com. Definitely leave feedback for us on iTunes or Stitcher. That helps other people find us so we can still stay the best UAV podcast out there. And you can get some swag at our Cafe Press store, or if you'd like, you can support the show at Patreon. Links to those are on our homepage, theuavdigest.com.
Next week, David, we're going to do something, well, again, a little bit different than our normal format for episodes of the UAV Digest.
Yeah, we had a successful experiment last month on Blab. So we'd like to invite everybody to join us next week at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Blab. Look up the UAV Digest on Blab, and we will have an open conversation, I guess.
That's right. What we'll do is we'll be on video in the Blab session. There'll be a chat room running alongside it that you can participate in, ask questions, and even ask to join the Blab, as it were, come into to the video and ask us your questions live. So again, it's a very different kind of a flavor to it, a lot more interactive. We hope you'll join us next week at 9 o'clock Eastern Time, and we look forward to it.
So I guess with that, I'm going to say this is David in Chili Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.